We're going to look, starting at Judges chapter 10. I think I will just make mention of one point to begin with, perhaps acknowledging this and suggesting an explanation. You have in Hebrews 11 a chapter devoted to faith in many different respects, including the great things that have been done by faith. And in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32, "And what more shall I say, for time will fail me, if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, and Samuel, and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire," etc. Now, some people have understood that passage to imply that God was endorsing what those men did. We looked last night at Gideon, and while in the first part of his life he did obey God in getting an army together and fighting against the Midianites, after that it's pretty much downhill, and there's not a whole lot to commend in Gideon's character. I don't think this passage is saying that everything Gideon did was commendable. We're going to look tonight and tomorrow night at some judges that I'm not sure there's anything in and of themselves that I would say was commendable about them, though there were great things they accomplished. God can do great things even through some very doubtful characters. And I think that's the point in that passage. So I don't believe I'm bound by Hebrews 11 to somehow find the good in men like Jephthah and Samson. I'm going to just look at what I think the text in Judges is saying about them. Now, if you think that Hebrews 11 means there's good in them, then you'll have to reinterpret some of this somewhere along the line. But in my judgment, that's not what it's saying. So in Judges chapter 10, after Abimelech died, Tola arose to save Israel. That's verses 1 and 2. And then after him, in verse 3, Jair, the Gileadite, arose and judged Israel for 22 years. And so those two judges are like those kind of not much said about them judges. We don't know a lot about the context or what all happened with them. But now come to verse 6. "Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, served the Baals and the Ashtaroth, the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the sons of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines. Thus they forsook the Lord and did not serve him." They turned to any and every god except the Lord. They seem to have kind of a propensity for doing things that actually are directly offensive to God. And they seem to be going from bad to worse. And so they served really here seven groups of gods. And the last two are important, the gods of the Ammonites and the gods of the Philistines, because that's going to set us up for this next narrative. In verse 7, "The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the sons of Ammon. They afflicted and crushed the sons of Israel that year. For 18 years they afflicted all the sons of Israel who were beyond the Jordan in Gilead in the land of the Amorites. The sons of Ammon crossed the Jordan to fight also against Judah, Benjamin, and the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was greatly distressed." So God sells the Israelites into the hand of the Philistines, that would be kind of to the southwest, and the Ammonites, which is in the far east, in between that strip of 2.5 tribes and the desert. Now, really, that's preparing us for the whole section from Judges 10 through 16. Because we're first going to deal with Jephthah fighting against the Ammonites in chapters 10 to 12, and then Samson dealing with the Philistines in chapters 13 to 16. So really, we're seeing the background for the next seven chapters here. So the Ammonites not only afflict the Gilead region, those 2.5 tribes, but they cross over the Jordan and extend their activities into Israel's heartland. Verse 10, "Then the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord, saying, 'We have sinned against you. For indeed we have forsaken our God and served the Baals. The Lord said to the sons of Israel, did I not deliver you from the Egyptians, the Amorites, the sons of Ammon, and the Philistines, also when the Sidonians, the Amalekites, and the Maonites oppressed you? You cried out to me, and I delivered you from their hands, yet you forsaken me and served other gods, therefore I will no longer deliver you. Go and cry out to the gods which you have chosen, let them deliver you in the time of your distress. Now the Lord here mentions how he has delivered them from seven nations. Remember, they followed seven sets of gods. There's also been seven judges to this point. That would be Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, Gideon, Tola, and Jair. I don't think Abimelech qualifies as a judge. He was just a usurping king. But they've cried out and said, we've sinned. We were wrong. You know, please rescue us. But the Lord sees through that. He sees how shallow their repentance is. It's awfully easy to say, I've sinned, bail me out, when we're in trouble. That doesn't necessarily mean we've really decided to turn to God and really serve him faithfully. It's kind of a manipulative form of repentance, if you will. They're turning to God to get something, and God was tired of being used. Their devotion to God was a charade. They're a bunch of parasites just trying to get the blessings they want to have instead of sincerely seeking the Lord and serving him. So, the Israelite response in verse 15, the sons of Israel said to the Lord, we have sinned. Do to us whatever seems good to you. Only please deliver us this day. You know, come on, please. We've sinned. We know it. We're wrong. It's all our fault. They really do say some of the things that you ought to say in a situation like this. But saying the words, well, they've said them over and over again. And they keep relapsing. And they seem awfully concerned about getting delivered. That seems to be the bottom line for them. You know, say whatever you need to say to get these enemies off your back. So they put away their foreign gods from among them and served the Lord. And there's a translation question about this. Literally in my margin, his soul was short with the misery. And so what that means is difficult. I think it means that the Lord was really aggravated and really angry with them. Now, my translation in the text says he could bear the misery of Israel no longer, almost implying that the Lord felt bad for them. But I think the better way to translate that is the Lord was still upset with them in spite of the fact they said the right words. They even got rid of the idols. But you know, do you ever do that? You change whatever you need to change when you're really in trouble. And when you really need the Lord's help, I got to have you right now, come on, I'll do anything. And you start, all of a sudden, you start giving like you've never given before. You start coming to church like you've never come to church before. You start reading the Bible like you've never read it before and start praying like you've never prayed before. And then as soon as the blessing comes, you're right back to where you started from. Well, the Lord can figure out what's going on with that. You know when you're getting used. Why wouldn't the Lord know that? So verse 17, then the sons of Ammon were summoned, and they camped in Gilead, and the sons of Israel gathered together and camped in Mizpah. The people, the leaders of Gilead, said to one another, who is the man who will begin to fight against the sons of Ammon? He shall become head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. They are not asking the Lord, but they're asking each other. You know, they want to volunteer, and they're offering the carrot of leadership. You can rule over us if you can get the Ammonites off our back. Now, Jephthah, chapter 11, the Gileadite, was a valiant warrior, but he was a son of a harlot, and Gilead was the father of Jephthah. Gilead's wife bore him sons, and when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, you shall not have an inheritance in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman. So Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob. And worthless fellows gathered themselves about Jephthah, and they went out with him. Jephthah reminds you in a few ways of Abimelech. I'll let you think about that. But his half-brothers drove him out because they didn't want to split the inheritance with this half-brother who was the son of their father and a harlot. And so they drove him out, and he gets a bunch of, well, kind of roughnecks to join with him and develops them into a pretty powerful fighting force. They're in trouble. They need help from somewhere. The Lord said, go talk to your gods. They know that's not going to do any good. Verse 4, it came about after a while that the sons of Ammon fought against Israel. When the sons of Ammon fought against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tob. And they said to Jephthah, come and be our chief that we may fight against the sons of Ammon. Then Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, did you not hate me and drive me from my father's house? So why have you come to me now when you're in trouble? The elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, for this reason we've now returned to you, that you may go with us and fight with the sons of Ammon and become head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. So Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, if you take me back to fight against the sons of Ammon and the Lord gives them up to me, will I become your head? The elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, the Lord is witness between us. Surely we will do as you have said. Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and chief over them. And Jephthah spoke all his words before the Lord at Mizpah. So they turn to Jephthah. That shows you how bad they're hurting. They've thrown him away and didn't want to have anything to do with them until they felt really, well, they didn't know where else to turn. You know, he's kind of their last resort. They're in distress. And do you get the feeling you're getting kind of a rerun of their conversation with the Lord when they talk to Jephthah? You know, and Jephthah sees through it about as well as the Lord did. He knows they're trying to use him. And he negotiates with them from a position of strength and says, well, you really going to make me your head if I deliver you from the Ammonites? And, you know, the elders and Jephthah pretty much deserve each other. They're both rather ambitious in this thing. But they turn to him in this desire to get a bailout, just like they had the Lord. And Jephthah says, okay, you make me your head, and we'll see what we can do. So, verse 12, I tell you, you can start seeing some things in Jephthah. We'll see this in this next section. Jephthah talks to the Ammonites. I just want you to notice what you've already seen about Jephthah, plus this. What's Jephthah's, what's one of his great abilities? In verse 12, now Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the sons of Ammon, saying, what is between you and me that you've come to me to fight against my land? The king of the sons of Ammon said to the messengers of Jephthah, because Israel took away my land when they came up from Egypt, from the Arnon, as far as the Jabbok and the Jordan. Therefore, return them peaceably now. But Jephthah sent messengers again to the king of the sons of Ammon, and they said to him, thus says Jephthah. Now, do you get the overall picture here? The Ammonites, they are wedged in between the 2.5 tribes in the desert. They don't have a lot of room for expansion because you can't really go to the desert. So the other direction is to invade Israel, which they did on various opportune occasions. It's amazing how consistently the Bible portrays the Ammonites invading Gilead. They did it here. Remember the first battle Saul fought as king was against Nahash, the Ammonite king who was trying to gouge the right eye out of the men of Jabesh Gilead because he wanted to expand his land. There's a number of statements in the prophets that you see the same thing in. For example, Amos 1:13, for 3 transgressions of the sons of Ammon and for 4, I will not revoke its punishment because they ripped open the pregnant women of Gilead in order to enlarge their borders. Different time period, same attitude. You see it again in Zephaniah chapter 2 and verse 8. I've heard the taunting of Moab and the revilings of the sons of Ammon with which they have taunted my people and become arrogant against their territory. They wanted territorial expansion in the days of Zephaniah. And also in Jeremiah chapter 49 and in verse 2, therefore behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, that I will cause a trumpet blast of war to be heard against Ammon of the sons of Ammon. And he says Israel will take possession of his possessors. And the idea is that the ones who'd been invading their territory, Israel was going to conquer back. So Ammon has just kind of this constant thing of when they get a little military might, they invade Gilead. It's interesting, the consistency of the Bible record in that. You may remember something about where the Ammonites came from. Do you remember that? That the Ammonites were from Lot and one of his daughters. They were kind of cousins to the Moabites. And we'll see that actually in what Jephthah is about to say. Modern Amman, Jordan, is from the word Ammonites. You can see Amman in that. That's kind of the territory where they were in. So the Ammonites are saying, hey, when you left Egypt, you took our land. We just want you to give it back. Fair is fair, right? Well, listen to what Jephthah says through his messengers. Verse 15. Thus says Jephthah, Israel did not take away the land of Moab nor the land of the sons of Ammon. For when they came up from Egypt and Israel went through the wilderness to the Red Sea and came to Kadesh, then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom saying, please let us pass through your land. But the king of Edom would not listen, and they also sent to the king of Moab, but he would not listen, so Israel remained at Kadesh. Then they went through the wilderness and around the land of Edom and the land of Moab and came to the east side of the land of Moab, and they camped beyond the Arnon, but they did not enter the territory of Moab, for the Arnon was the border of Moab. Israel sent messengers to Sihon, the king of the Amorites, not Ammonites. This is a different nation, the Amorites, the king of Heshbon. And Israel said to him, please let us pass through your land to our place. But Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his territory. So Sihon gathered all his people and camped at Jahaz and fought with Israel. The Lord, the God of Israel, gave Sihon and all his people into the hand of Israel, and they defeated them. So Israel possessed all the land of the Amorites, the inhabitants of that country. So they possessed all the territory of the Amorites from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok and from the wilderness as far as the Jordan. Since now the Lord, the God of Israel, drove out the Amorites from before his people Israel, are you then to possess it? Do you not possess what Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? So whatever the Lord our God has driven out before us, we will possess it. Now, are you any better than Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever strive with Israel? Did he ever fight against them? While Israel lived in Heshbon and its villages, in Aroer and its villages, and in all the cities that are on the banks of the Arnon, 300 years, why did you not recover them within that time? I therefore have not sinned against you, but you are doing me wrong by making war against me. May the Lord the judge judge today between the sons of Israel and the sons of Ammon. But the king of the sons of Ammon disregarded the message which Jephthah sent him. So look what he said. This is the messengers for Jephthah talking to the Ammonites saying, we never took any land from Lot's descendants. In fact, we had a history when we came out of Egypt of respecting international boundaries. We didn't go through Edom. We didn't go through Moab because when we asked permission, they said no. When we asked permission to go through the territory of Sihon, the Amorite, he came and fought us. We only fought when we were attacked. We took the land, only the land that we gained in battle when we were attacked. The land belonged to Sihon the Amorite, not to you Ammonites. God gave us this territory. If Chemosh, your God, gave you something, you'd take it. Why shouldn't we take the territory that God gave us when we fought against Sihon, the Ammonite king? Now, do you see that whole logic that he's developing there? It's a pretty powerful argument, it seems to me. And he says, besides, if that land was really your land, why have you waited 300 years to say something about it? That's a pretty good argument too, don't you think? Now, what do you see in Jephthah? You know, what does he do when they come and try to get him to fight? What does he do when the Ammonites are claiming that territory? He is a good talker. He's a good arguer. He's a good negotiator. He negotiated with the Israelites to make him king, more or less, head, chief. He negotiates or tries to with the Ammonites to back them down, saying, you have no business with fighting us over this territory. Now, look at verse 28. The king of the sons of Ammon disregarded the message which Jephthah sent him. Now, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, so that he passed through Gilead and Manasseh. Then he passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he went on to the sons of Ammon. Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. So Jephthah crossed over to the sons of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand. He struck them with a very great slaughter from Aroer to the entrance of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel Karamim. So the sons of Ammon were subdued before the sons of Israel. Now, God's Spirit came on Jephthah. God gave Jephthah the power to whip the Ammonites. He didn't have the character to use it very well, but he did that. In spite of the fact that God's Spirit was upon Jephthah and he had every bit of the power he needed to defeat the Ammonites, he tries to bargain with God. He wants to negotiate with him. And so he makes this vow and says to God, if you'll give me the Ammonites, I'll sacrifice the first person that comes out of my house. Now, that's kind of a Jephthah-type thing to do. He's a negotiator. He's a good talker. And he's kind of slipping a bribe under the table to the Lord. I'll sacrifice whoever the first one is that comes out of my house. But now think about that a minute. You know, you don't use the same tactics with God that you use with the Israelites and with the Ammonites. You don't bargain with him. You don't offer him something and say, well, I'll sacrifice the first person that comes out of my house if you'll give me the victory. Furthermore, where did anyone think that God would want a human sacrifice? I think what you see in Jephthah is the reflection of a whole lot of paganism, a whole lot of Canaan in the Israelites by this point. So he didn't need to do it. God's Spirit had already come upon him, and God's supreme. And it really takes the focus off the Lord's victory, and it becomes, you know, I promised this to God, and so he gave me the victory. Now, there's always debate about what it was that Jephthah was offering and what he did. But the word means, in verse 31, a whole burnt offering. It's not, wouldn't normally be that an animal would come out of the house to greet a victorious returning army captain. And if he was just saying, oh, I'll offer an animal to you. Well, they offered animals all the time. That doesn't seem like that would have been, in his eyes, much of a bargaining chip. So I think he just has a pagan notion. And he thinks God will be impressed if he's offering the first person that comes out of his house. He didn't dream who it would be. And so Jephthah delivered Israel from the Ammonites, ironically, a people who sacrificed their children to Molech, their god. And in verse 34, when Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, behold, his daughter was coming out to meet him with tambourines and with dancing. Now she was his one and only child. Besides her, he had no son or daughter. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and said, alas, my daughter! You brought me very low, and you are among those who trouble me. For I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot take it back. So she said to him, my father, you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me as you have said, since the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the sons of Ammon. She said to her father, let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months, that I may go to the mountains and weep because of my virginity, I and my companions. Then he said, go. So he sent her away for 2 months, and she left with her companions and wept on the mountains because of her virginity. At the end of 2 months, she returned to her father, who did to her according to the vow which he had made. And she had no relations with a man. Thus it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to commemorate the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in the year. Isn't this typical of abusive parents? Who does he blame when she comes out to congratulate him? Her! as if he is the victim and she's the one that did wrong by coming out to celebrate the victory. It's all abusive parents do that sort of thing. They try to place the blame on their children. That should never be done in this kind of a situation. And she's his only child. Doesn't have a son, only daughter. So he effectively disinherits himself. He regained the inheritance, but he won't have any because he has no heir now. And, he thinks, well, he's got to fulfill the vow. Of course, obedience is better than sacrifice. And surely with a vow offering a human sacrifice, but Jephthah does not know that. Since he did according to his vow, I understand that he sacrificed his daughter. I realize there are other explanations people have come up with. You may believe them. That's okay. I won't try to argue with you about that. But it seems to me that he did what he said he would do. And so Abimelech had sacrificed his half-brothers. Jephthah sacrifices his daughter. There's a lot of bad things going on in Israel. And then look at this. Chapter 12. Then the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they crossed to Zaphon and said to Jephthah, "Why did you cross over to fight against the sons of Ammon without calling us to go with you? We will burn your house down on you." Jephthah said to them, "I and my people were at great strife with the sons of Ammon. When I called you, you did not deliver me from their hand. When I saw that you would not deliver me, I took my life in my hands and crossed over against the sons of Ammon, and the Lord gave them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me?" Then Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead and fought Ephraim. The men of Gilead defeated Ephraim because they said, "You are fugitives of Ephraim, O Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and in the midst of Manasseh." The Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan opposite Ephraim. And it happened when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, "Let me cross over," the men of Gilead would say to him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" If he said no, then they would say to him, "Say now Shibboleth." But he said Sibboleth. He could not pronounce it correctly. Then they seized him and slew him at the fords of the Jordan. Thus there fell at that time 42,000 of Ephraim. Then Jephthah judged Israel 6 years. Then Jephthah the Gileadite died and was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. Now do you see the problem? It reminds you so much of Judges 8 and the controversy with the Ephraimites that Gideon had. And you remember how Gideon humbles himself and compliments the Ephraimites, and the soft answer turned away wrath. In this case, Jephthah says, "Well, you were nowhere to be found when I took my life into my own hands and courageously resisted the Ammonites." Anything but a soft answer. He responds defensively, aggressively, throws salt in the wound, and further aggravates and irritates them. The Ephraimites, now think about it, the Ephraimites are now over fighting against the Ammonites in Gilead on the right-hand side of the Jordan. And the Ephraimites say that the Gileadites are fugitives. They're people who really, they'd like to be in mainland Israel, but they've had to flee over to the other side because they're not good enough to be with them. Well, that burns the Gileadites up. So they seize the fords of the Jordan, the places where you can cross the Jordan, ford the Jordan. And as people want to come across, they say, "Are you an Ephraimite?" They say, "No." They say, "Okay, say Shibboleth." We're not even sure what Shibboleth means, either an ear of corn or a flowing stream. But it really doesn't matter what it means. The issue was, they have a different dialect. You know, people in Boston don't talk the same as people in Birmingham, right? You know, it's a little different. And you can have to say just about any word, and you can come up with the difference between those two. And so the Ephraimites can't say Shibboleth, they say Sibboleth. It's kind of like the difference between saying save the queen and shave the queen. Doesn't mean quite the same thing. And so because they can't get the sh sound, their dialect comes up with just the more pure S sound, then they can determine if they're an Ephraimite or not. If they say it's Sibboleth, then they kill them, because they're really an Ephraimite that's trying to cross back over. More Israelites died at Jephthah's hand 42,000 that is recorded in the whole rest of the book. Here, the deliverer turned destroyer. God is allowing the nation to self-destruct as they go farther and farther away from him. As the lows get lower and lower, as the time of repentance gets more and more superficial, the Israelites become their own worst enemy. The time of the peace now becomes much shorter than the time of their oppression. When we've got this attitude where we want to use God and we're just trying to manipulate him, we're in trouble. God, please help me. I love you a lot. But when everything's okay, we don't need him. He does see through that. And he eventually, he delivered them from the Ammonites and turned them over to Jephthah, which was in some ways worse than having the Ammonites oppressing them. God does punish. And this deliverer they found, who God empowered to deliver them from the Ammonites, turned against them and created quite a scene. Now look at verse 8. Now Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel after him. He had 30 sons and 30 daughters whom he gave in marriage outside the family. And he brought in 30 daughters from outside for his sons. And he judged Israel 7 years. The thing I want you to notice about that, that's just one of the minor judges that we're not spending a whole lot of time with. But among all the judges, daughters are mentioned only in connection with Jephthah and Ibzan. And Ibzan has 30 of them, which kind of contrasts with the lack of daughters now that Jephthah has, or sons for that matter. Ibzan's blessed with many. And after Ibzan, it's Elon and then Abdon, and all of those three are just brief mentions of judges. We don't know the whole story about them, but it does tell us there were various oppressions and deliverances in various parts of the country during this whole period. We're told the information that the Lord wants us to have. We can see great lessons in each of the judges that we are given more information about. And it helps us to think about our own life and conduct. I mean, are we sincerely serving the Lord? Or do we serve the Lord just to get something from him? Are we using him, or are we living for him? Tonight, he offers salvation to those who are willing to come to him. But that salvation comes on the basis of our true repentance and turning to him. If it's just a charade, if it's just something we're doing either to get something from him or maybe even to make ourselves look good in front of somebody else, the Lord knows. He knows our heart. He sees that. But if we're willing to sincerely serve him, we'll not be perfect, but we'll try. And we'll really turn to him with a whole heart, with a pure and sincere heart. He wants us to come to him. Won't you do that? All together we stand and sing.